Your conference is being recorded.
Good afternoon and welcome to our Trust Education Program. This is Kelly McDonough with Bank of Oklahoma, Advisor Trust Services. We've created this program to support the RIA community in the area of trust as we develop relationships through our advisor-friendly trust services. Please join us next month, February 22nd, for a session focused on estate planning with retirement assets with Bob Kirkland of Kirkland Woods and Martinson in Kansas City. As you're aware, each program has a professional presenter discussing aspects of trust and estate planning specifically geared toward the advisor community. If you have any suggestions on future speakers or specific content that you'd like to see presented or just other general comments and feedback to improve our program, we'd love to hear them. We are pleased to have several of our markets participating in today's presentation. So as a housekeeping issue, this call will be recorded for future use. So we would appreciate you putting your phone on mute so we can minimize any of the background noise. If you have questions or something comes up that would be more state-specific in nature, your local host or trust manager can address those with you specifically. If time permits, we'll address questions at the end of the session today. This, as well as future programs, is approved for 1.5 CFP CE credits, so please make sure you sign in at the end of the table and include your CFP number, and we'll go ahead and submit your participation in the program online for you so you'll get credit for your attendance. Today, our presenter is Dylan Metzner with Riley, Carlock, and Applewhite, and our topic is Tax Cuts and Job Act Implications for Individuals. If you have any questions along the way, please feel free to ask during the presentation or jot them down, and we'll ask at the end of the presentation. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dylan today. He is a member of the estate planning and tax practice in Riley, Carlock, and Applewhite office in Denver. He helps individuals and families nationally and internationally with their private wealth planning. Dylan focuses on designing plans to minimize tax ramifications and family conflict. Dylan helps his clients identify their family values and goals, and he develops legal structures to honor these values and goals while protecting his clients' wealth for themselves and their future generations. Dylan's clients include high net worth individuals, corporate executives, closely held business owners, and professionals often working in the medical field. Dylan advises his clients on tax advantage entity structures, including family limited partnerships and limited liability companies, complex trusts, trust structure to hold inherited qualified plans such as IRAs and 401ks, split interest trusts, grantor trusts, and life insurance trusts. Dylan also advises his clients on a myriad of business planning issues, including choice of entity, selection, maintenance, and business succession planning. So we are very excited to have him joining us today. And Dylan, we appreciate your support of BOK Financial. And I will go ahead and turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you very much, Crystal. I also want to introduce my partner who's kind enough to join us today. His name's Mark Bosco. He's also with our estate planning, tax, and transactional group here in Riley, Carlock, and Applewhite's Denver office. Mark also does a lot of work with complex real estate and lending transactions and business acquisitions and sales. So I'm glad to have my partner Mark here on the call with me.
Glad to be here.
As you guys will see, we have an agenda today that has three main points. And I want to talk really about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And while we named this presentation 20 Implications for Individuals, the focus being the RIA Trust Education Program, you'll see we'll spend much more time talking about implications on estate planning, on trusts, on and things like that. But I do, given the newness of this act, think it's appropriate and to just do a rundown through some of the other provisions talking about the effective dates, income tax on individuals, estates, and trusts. We're not going to get into any of the corporate tax changes. But I do think an overview of the income tax changes will be beneficial. Do not worry. We've got an hour and a half of presentation time, and we're not going to fill your time with an hour and a half of code talk. We'll we'll spend a lot of time, I hope the majority of the time, talking about kind of opportunities for you and for your clients and things that you and your clients need to watch out for. So for without further ado, we'll go down the agenda and start with the overview of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. I'll just call that the Act. The effective date, most of these provisions are effective for taxable years beginning after 2017, so January 1st, 2018. There's a few exceptions to that. We'll talk about some changes to the itemized deduction for medical expenses. These changes are retroactive to January of 2017. The elimination of the alimony deduction, that will not be effective until January of next year, January of 2017. And then the mortgage deduction changes, took place for debt that was incurred after December 15, 2017. The main thing, an important item to consider, not the main thing, but a very important item to consider is that just like we had a sunset in 2013, for those of you who remember that, most of these individual provisions sunset again on December 31st, 2025. The reason for that is the Act, the provision was required to allow the Act to pass under what's called the reconciliation process. And the Senate would move this through under the reconciliation process, so they only needed a majority of votes to pass this Tax Act. If the provisions didn't sunset, the Tax Act would have required more than a majority, and none of the Democrats were voting for that, so this wouldn't have passed. So most of the individual provisions sunset in 2025. This will be a common theme throughout today's presentation. One of the individual items that does not sunset is a very important provision that I think a lot of people aren't aware of, and this is the inflation adjustment. Historically, tax brackets and the dollar thresholds were calculated using the consumer price index for all urban consumers. We refer to that as the CPIU. The Act changes that to now the inflation adjustment is based on the chained consumer price index urban, so chained CPIU. This is one of the most significant long-term changes affecting how much individuals and estates and trusts will pay in tax in the future. The chained CPIU rises slower than the CPIU, and the net effect of that over time is going to be to subject more income to higher tax rates as the brackets are adjusted based on this slower measure of inflation. Again, this is the only permanently enacted change for individuals, and the reason that's permanent is because it does not increase the deficit. On the bottom of page one of the outline, we have a chart showing the net effect over time, and the blue bars indicate what the inflation adjustments would have been or expected to be under the CPIU. The green brackets show the inflation adjustments under the chain CPIU. So you see over the first few years, there's not a huge change, but when you get to 2025 and onward, we're going to have more income subject to higher tax rates. Pages two and three of the outline are just tables showing pre-reform tax brackets and the tax brackets after this Act. We're not going to go over these in detail. This is more, if anything, this may be something you want to keep on your bulletin board or handy. It's a easy way to see where things are. Again, remember, these dollar thresholds are today's dollars, and they will increase pursuant to the chained CPIU. The one thing I do want to note on page three is that while the thresholds for tax and estates and trusts haven't changed, the rates have changed. So there is some tax savings for estates and trusts, not much. The takeaways that I would want you to take to get from these tax brackets when you look at them in more detail later on is that the Act continues to preserve the seven tax brackets. The rates go down, so the rates are moving, the higher rates are starting from the 15% rate moves to 12%, 25% to 22%, 28 to 24, 33 to 32, 35 stays at 35, and then the top rate of 39.6 drops to 37%. What you'll also see is that the marriage penalty does still exist for taxpayers in the top tax bracket. So they've eliminated the marriage penalty for a number of taxpayers, but if you have a client clients that are in the highest tax bracket and they are unmarried but considering marriage, the marriage penalty does still come into a play. What you'll also notice is the standard deduction has increased, and that's roughly almost doubled for each taxpayer. But the personal exemption is limited, which could offset some of the benefits of the almost doubling of the standard deduction. So with the increase of the standard deduction and the elimination of the personal exemption, it may produce a modest tax savings for some taxpayers, but not all. The largest impact of the increased standard deduction is that it will reduce the need for many taxpayers to itemize deductions. However, as we'll discuss later, many of these itemized deductions have been removed, so the increase of the standard deduction does not necessarily mean your clients, and especially those clients who have itemized in the past, we'll see a decrease in taxes. Also, with the increase of the standard deduction, many taxpayers will not realize any income tax benefits from home mortgage interest payments, which change a little bit, state and local tax payments, which definitely change, or payments still qualifying as deductions to those who itemize their deductions. Now, moving to the next bullet point, the kiddie tax. The kiddie tax is an often overlooked tax that comes to take some clients by surprise. And what the kiddie tax is, it's a tax on unearned income of a child, and the unearned income, of course, includes interest, dividends, and capital gains. So in the kiddie tax is taxed unearned income, and the tax is at the parent's highest tax rate. So the purpose of the kiddie tax is to discourage wealthy individuals from transferring income-producing property to their children who would otherwise be taxed at a lower rate. While the Act continues the kiddie tax, it actually increases the amount of tax that will be paid, or has the potential and probably in most cases will increase the amount of tax that has to be paid. Under the Act, the kiddie tax now taxes the unearned income at ordinary income rates and capital gain rates applicable to trust and estates. This is different than their parents. This is a much more compressed tax bracket. If you look back on page 3, you'll see that for estates and trusts, those entities are taxed at the highest rate if there's income in excess of $12,500. So with the change to the kiddie tax, what Congress is saying now is if a child has unearned income in excess of $12,500, that excess will be taxed at the highest taxable rate, 37% ordinary income. And if we're talking about capital gains or qualified dividends, we're at a 20% rate right there. So that's going to take a lot of people by surprise. And this is very important for you and for your clients to understand because we see many, many clients that set up UTMA accounts for their children. Historically, these UTMA accounts were taxed at the parents' rate, but now they're going to be taxed at much more compressed tax brackets. So this, you may see clients now adjusting their investments in the UTMA accounts to minimize tax recognition, and moving forward, rather than contributing to an UTMA account, parents may want to consider making contributions to an irrevocable, what we call, grantor trust for the child. This type of trust, the grantor trust, and we'll talk more about this as in the planning opportunity section, but a grantor trust is one where the parents are responsible for paying the tax on the trust, and it's at the parents' rate. The upside of this is, okay, we're back at the parents' rates. The downside to this is that the parents, not the trust, is responsible for paying these taxes, and that could have a major effect on your cash flow projections for your clients. Moving on now to the net investment income tax, the NIT. And there, much has been said about the last-minute effective repeal of the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And while the act does effectively repeal this mandate, the repeal does not become effective until January of next year, so January 1st, 2019. And the act does not change or do away with the NIT tax, the 3.8% on net investment income, nor does it do away with the 0.9% tax, additional Medicare tax imposed on individuals. So these taxes, which came into being around the Affordable Care Act time, and a lot of people associate with the Affordable Care Act, are still in play under the new act. As a reminder, the NIT threshold is $250,000 for married couples, $200,000 for singles and head of households, and again, $12,500 for estates and trusts, bringing back and thus children subject to the kiddie tax. One other thing that had some advisors concerned and worried, especially with the Senate bill version of the bill, was what's going to happen for the cost basis of sold securities. The Senate version of the bill would have required that the cost basis of securities sold, exchanged, or otherwise disposed of would be determined on a first-in, first-out basis rather than a basis elected by the taxpayer. So historically, the taxpayer could, if they sold securities, could elect to determine the cost basis on a FIFO basis, on a LIFO basis, on an average basis. And the Senate bill was going to do away with that and say, no, it's all got to be first in, first out, which would have theoretically mean more tax because the first in securities probably have a lower basis than the most recently purchased securities. Fortunately, much to the relief of many of our clients, many of the financial advisors we work with, and hopefully all of you guys on the phone, this provision was not in the final bill, so investors may still choose specific shares or lots of securities to sell, and they are not required to use the FIFO treatment. Let's talk about the deductions. The act, individual or the itemized deductions. The act eliminates most individual deductions, and of note to this group is the elimination of the deduction for investment expenses. So no longer will a client be able to deduct in expenses relating to their investment of their assets. This also affects trust and estates because no longer are trust administration fees or estate expenses deductible. The good news is, fortunately, is the elimination of the deductions is set to sunset along with all the other changes to individuals and trust and estates at the end of 2025. But until that time, these deductions are gone and they may never come back. The Some of the major itemized deductions, we've talked about the investment expense, casualty losses. An exception to that is if there's a federally declared disaster, so floodplains or anything like that. Moving expenses are also, can also no longer be deducted unless, the client's in the armed services. And a major, major change is that alimony is no longer deductible. So this will affect some of our colleagues in the family law arena with regards to divorce settlements. The Act does continue to provide for a charitable deduction, and it provides that charitable contributions are deductible with an increased deduction limitation on cash contributions from 50% of adjusted gross income to 60% of adjusted gross income. So before this act, clients could make cash contributions to a public charity or donor advised fund, and they would be able to deduct 50% of their AGI for that year. With the new act, they can now deduct 60% of their AGI for the new year. We'll keep this in the back of your mind, and we'll talk about this as a planning opportunity. But what you may see from time to time because of this is bunching deductions in different years. Contributions of stock and appreciated property to a charity and cash contributions to a private foundation or a charitable lead trust remain at 30%. Another major change to the deductions is the SALT issue, and this is a state and local tax, including property tax. We all often refer to this as SALT. And the deduction for SALT, not related to a trade or business, is retained, so it doesn't go away, but it is capped at $10,000, and this cap is not indexed for inflation, so it will not increase for married couples and $5,000 for individuals. This is going to be a significant issue for our taxpayers that are living in higher income states, and this will be something you may see a lot of your clients doing with trusts, is relocating or changing the situs or domicile of those trusts to a low or no income tax state. As an anecdote, we've been hearing some rumors, Mark, I think it was out of New York, that they're the states are proposing to establish a public charity whose purpose is to benefit the state, and the state will allow 100% deduction or credit for state income tax purposes. We'll see if this actually happens, but the states are definitely not happy about this. Our friends in California, Minnesota, New York, they are this is really detrimental to them. Moving downwards to the mortgage interest deduction. The mortgage interest deduction remains, but we have a limitation on the amount of indebtedness that the deduction is available to. Historically, it's been the deduction has been available on interest for up to $1 million of debt. That has been moved down to $750,000 in debt. And again, this limitation is not indexed. So as we continue to see property values appreciate, we're going to see less and less of a deduction that's available when it relates to the overall property of the home. Medical expenses, the Act does retain medical expense deduction, and this is the one deduction where the Act actually offers some favorability in the next year or so. The Act expands the deduction for 2 years by reducing the threshold from 10% of AGI to 7.5% of AGI. So medical expenses are deductible to the extent they exceed 7.5% of the client's AGI, and that's effective for tax year 2017, so that's a retroactive change, and for 2018. In 2019, the threshold increases back up to 10% of AGI. Another, one of probably the most significant or major deductions that is being talked about and you guys have probably heard about is what is officially called the qualified business income deduction. This is the 20% deduction for pass-through entities. This is the small business assistance. I want to give a disclaimer because this overview is going to be very general, very simplified. This is one of the most complex portions of the Act, but because this has been talked about and praised so much by the administration, pundits, news, everyone loves this provision. I'm sure your clients are looking at it, and so we'd like to give you a quick overview of this provision. And so as we said, this is one of the most talked about provisions of the Act, and this is a 20% deduction for owners of certain pass-through entities such as limited liability companies, S corporations, and partnerships. This 20% deduction is in addition to the increased standard deduction and is in addition to any deduction, any itemized deduction if the taxpayer itemizes their deductions. So the way this works is income from pass-through entities right now and historically has been taxed at the owner's individual tax rates. And under the new Act, individual tax rates can be as high as 37%. So for these pass-through entities, the income it receives is taxed, can be taxed as high as 37%. The Act reduces the corporate tax rates to a flat 21%, and Congress wanted to provide a similar decrease to smaller businesses who are not taking the corporate form. So therefore, they introduced this deduction, the 20% deduction on qualified business income, QBI. We call it the QBI deduction. So what is qualified business income? Well, qualified business income is generally the net amount of income, gain, deduction, and loss from an active trade or business within the United States. QBI does not include most investment income, such as capital gains or interest, unless that interest is allocable to a trade or business, or qualified dividends, things like that. Therefore, family partnerships or other family entities that only hold securities will not be subject to the QBI deduction. While many commentators state the deduction is not applicable or available to service companies such as health, law, accounting, financial services, brokerage services, etc., that's not necessarily true. The deduction may be available to owners of those businesses if those owners' income is below a certain threshold. And that threshold is $315,000 for married individuals, $157,000 for single. The deduction is not available to owners who are trusts and who are trusts in estates. So our clients that we're working with that are trusts, we've got to look at some other options available for other options for them. They do not get this 20% deduction. Also, the deduction is not available for net investment income tax purposes, and also for taxpayers that are in high tax states, they're not happy at all because this deduction reduces federal taxable income, not AGI. So taxpayers in states which base their state income tax on AGI will receive no state tax benefit from this. So the state taxes are going to start becoming more and more of a big deal, especially for our clients who have the wherewithal or ability to choose the jurisdiction that they want to reside in. One other thing that I thought I would bring up in this topic, because I think it's important for the participants in the call to make sure they know this and are talking about expanded opportunities for their clients, is the Act does make a change to the 529 plans. And this is a good change. The Act expands application of 529 accounts, now allowing distributions for tuition at public, private, or religious elementary or secondary schools. These distributions are capped at $10,000 a year, But now clients that do send their children to private school can utilize 529 plans to pay for tuition up to $10,000 per student per year. All righty. So that is an overview of a really high-level 30, maybe even 60,000-foot overview of the income tax provisions of this act and how they affect individuals. We talked a little bit how they affect trusts and estates. But let's now talk about really what we are seeing a lot of planning opportunities and what you guys should be looking for with your clients in wealth transfer and estate planning opportunities. So for estate gift and generation skipping transfers, the key highlights are the Act doubles the exclusion amount for these three taxes, the estates and gifts tax, which have the unified credit essentially, and the generation skipping transfer tax. The exemption amount is now doubled, so to $11.2 million for individuals. Portability remains, so if a spouse dies without using all of their exemption amount, that unused exemption amount can be ported to the surviving spouse. So for married couples, we have a total of $22.4 million of exclusion. And this is indexed for inflation, so it's going to continue to go up. Also, the step-up in basis remains upon death. So what the step-up in basis is upon a decedent's death, her assets will be valued, her basis in the assets will get a new basis as of the date of death value. This is a huge, huge planning opportunity and what we're seeing a lot of for our clients. We'll talk more about this in a minute, but for right now, know that the step up in basis remains. Finally, the annual exclusion amount for gift tax increased from $14,000 per donee. It is now $15,000 per donee. So husband and wife can contribute a total of $30,000 a year per donee without filing any gift tax return. These provisions, though, like all of the other individual provisions we talked about, sunset in 2025. What has us a little concerned, and I think I'll be more concerned when we get closer to 2025, is that the Act directs the Department of Treasury to prescribe regulations as may be necessary to address any decrease in the exclusion amount in 2026. What does this mean? Basically, this leaves open the possibility of a clawback for gifts made prior to 2026. For example, let's say we have a client that makes a gift of $10 million when his exclusion amount is $11 million. So he's used $10 million of the exclusion amount. And then he dies after 2026 when the exclusion amount, let's say it goes back to $5.6 million. It is possible that the IRS may attempt to invoke some type of clawback for this gift, either taxing the gift retroactively, which I doubt, that doesn't seem very logical and maybe difficult to do. I think more likely would be they would include a portion of the gift into the decedent's estate, so they would tax the decedent's estate more. Again, we have no idea if this is ever going to happen. This was a major concern when the Bush tax cuts expired, and we had the we didn't know if the estate tax exemption amount was going to go down or not. There ended up being no clawback, but this remains a possibility that's out there that we're advising our clients on. And you know, my gut view right now is if there is a clawback, the sooner the gifts are made, the harder it is to claw those back. So if clients have the wherewithal and even with increased exemption amounts have taxable estates, a gifting plan sooner than later would at least give us a bigger argument that the clawback's invalid for whatever reason we have. So let's get into some of these estate planning considerations and opportunities in light of the changes to the estate gift and GST taxes. And the first one I want to look at with you guys is the first thing that all clients should do is review their current estate planning documents, and specifically with respect to formulaic approaches. I have a chart on page 5 that shows the history of these exclusion amounts, and I think this is going to highlight the issue that we are seeing quite often with our clients. It wasn't so long ago, 2001, so only, what are we in, 2018, so 17 years ago, that the exemption amount was $675,000. Almost all of our clients had had taxable estates, and we had to do some planning for that. It started going up in the early 2000s, went up to 1 million, then 1.5, 2 million, and 2009 we went up to 3.5, and then afterwards it stayed at around 5 million adjusted for inflation, with last year being 2017. What we would always, as estate planners, if clients had a taxable estate, we would often recommend, and clients would often take our recommendations, that we need to fund two types of trusts, a credit shelter trust and a marital trust. The purpose of those two trusts is to defer estate taxes until the death of the surviving spouse. The credit shelter trust would receive property up to the decedent's exemption amount, so in 2001, that would have been $675,000. And the rest would have gone to the marital trust, or maybe it would have gone outright to the surviving spouse. But we wanted to capture that exemption amount because also at that time, we didn't have portability. So until 2013, if a deceased client did not utilize their estate exemption amount, it was gone. It vanished, and we had a lost planning opportunity. So what we're seeing a lot of is, and especially in estate plans that I'm reviewing, go 2010 and older, we're seeing formulaic clauses that no longer work. And a perfect example of this would be in a second marriage. Assume that you had a client in 2000, had $5 million in net worth, and they wanted to make sure that no estate tax was paid upon death. This was a second marriage, so this client had remarried, and we'll use it as a him. He remarried, and he wanted to make sure his wife was taken care of for her lifetime, but also wanted to give his children from a prior marriage something upon his death, and then make sure everything goes after his surviving spouse dies, and whatever remains goes to his kids. Well, the estate plan you would see would likely say, okay, upon my death, an amount up to the exemption amount goes to my children outright, or maybe it goes to my children in a trust. Whatever remains goes to my spouse. This fit the client perfectly in 2001, because we had a $5 million estate, $675,000 is going to kids, and the remaining 4.3 and some change was going to the surviving spouse. Well, now with the exemption amounts going up and now being at 11.2, if that formulaic clause is still there and the client has not amended his estate plan, we now all of a sudden have a scenario where everything is going to the client's kids, which is not what the client intended. And frankly, we're setting up for litigation because the surviving spouse, unless there's a prenuptial agreement, will have a right to a portion of his estate. So with the increase of the exemption amount, it's a perfect opportunity for clients to review their estate plan. I I believe that a client should review their estate plan every 5 or so years. Life situations change, and for no other reason than that, they should review their estate plan. But not many of my clients heed that advice. This is a perfect opportunity to talk to your clients about reviewing their plan. And being the trusted advisors you are, you guys are going to be rock stars for recommending this to the client, or at least raising the issue to them. So the other opportunities here. Okay, well, now we're at $20 million, and I have this bullet point named "The Tax Tail Should Never Wag the Estate Planning Dog," and that's very hard for us estate planning tax attorneys to do, but it never should. And it really isn't for the majority of our clients now. In fact, in 2018, it's projected that under 2,000 decedents, under 2,000 people that die in the U.S., of 300 million, under 2,000 people that die in the U.S. this year, less than 2,000 will have to pay estate tax. So tax planning is becoming less and less of a transfer. Let me rephrase that. Planning for estate and gift taxes is becoming less and less of an issue for our clients. The focus now is planning for income taxes. So we're going to talk about that. But I said the tax tail should never wag the estate planning dog. So let's look at non-tax considerations that all clients should continue to look at, even in light of the new tax reform bill. And these are the advantages of using trusts in estate planning. Why would clients want to have a trust? Well, there are a couple of reasons. The most common reason I see is they want appropriate management of assets. They don't believe their beneficiaries are mature enough to manage the assets. And they've been working with financial advisors such as yourselves. They know what you do. They're very comfortable with the performance and the advice you're giving them. They want someone like you to continue managing these assets. So the vehicle that we create to have clients rest assured. That you're continuing to manage their assets is through a trust. And trusts are now becoming much, much more flexible. Historically, trusts would have the trustee, and the trustee was in charge of everything. All of you guys are familiar with BOKF, so I'm sure this is not the first time you've heard this discussion. But we are now moving to more and more of directed trusts, where you have a trustee that's responsible for the administrative functions, tax preparing, tax return preparation, accounting, perhaps the distribution functions, making distributions out to the beneficiaries. But the clients are directing that their RIAs should continue to manage the assets, and so in a trust, we bifurcate the investment function away from the trustee and put it in and give that to what we often call a trust director, trust advisor. There's a number of names for it, but they are legally responsible for managing the investments. And no party can take that away unless it's provided otherwise in the terms of the trust. So a trustee cannot remove the trust director's power to invest the assets. So we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of trust to ensure appropriate management of assets. Creditor protection is still there. Testamentary trust, even lifetime irrevocable trust, offer certain types of creditor protection for the beneficiaries. We're seeing not only creditor protection, and I guess a divorcing spouse is in a sense a creditor, but my clients, and we often refer to them as creditors. We also see trust as a mechanism for protection against divorce. The issue with that is historically trust property held in trust would not be included in a divorce calculation for if the beneficiary was getting divorced. That is slowly starting to change. Massachusetts has some very poor, what I believe is poor law, but it's the law, that says trust property and even expected inheritances may be included in the divorce calculation. Colorado isn't as stringent as Massachusetts, but our Supreme Court recently said that if a beneficiary of a trust goes through a divorce, their interest in the trust property is considered property for divorce purposes and so is taken into account. So while historically trusts in and of themselves would cause protection or would enjoy protection from a divorcing spouse, we often they are not as impenetrable as they used to be. So we generally recommend that clients who have established trust for their children or clients who have trust for their benefits, if they are contemplating getting married, we often recommend having a marital agreement or a prenuptial agreement that specifically provides the trust assets are not to be considered in a divorce. Another non-tax reason for using trust, and this is a biggie, is business succession planning. And I had a client a couple years ago, and it was about this plan took about a year to implement, but he had 7 children, and 2 of them were involved in the family business. The rest weren't. But he wanted all of his children to receive equal amounts. And he said, but, you know, equal amounts, 90% of my net worth tied up in the business. How do I do that? This business needs to continue. I don't want to force a sale of the business. How do we do this? Well, one of the things we did was we structured his estate plan. So the interest in the business went to a trust. We made sure we had a trustee who is familiar with the business, who is able to operate and manage the shares of the business. And the beneficiaries of that trust were all the children, all each entitled to an equal share of the profits that the business made, and no one child could force the sale of the business. So trusts are still used in business succession opportunities. Another reason, and this may be further down, but this is a definite non-tax planning reason for having trusts in an estate plan, is with regards to second marriages and ensuring that a surviving spouse does not disinherit a deceased spouse's children. So oftentimes you will see, like the example I used earlier, you have second marriage, this time wife wants to make sure husband's provided for his lifetime, but doesn't want to give the money outright to husband because husband can give it to a new spouse, give it to his kids, essentially do anything to disinherit wife's kids. So what we would do is rather than give it outright to a spouse, we'll put it into a trust for a spouse. The spouse has access, can use the trust property for his or her lifetime, and any property that remains at death would pass to the deceased spouse's children without fear that the surviving spouse disinherits them. So those are a lot of the non-tax planning items that we see for trust planning. Mark, have I missed anything? Is there any big one that you can think of that you think may be interesting to talk about?
You know, one of the areas that is often brought up are what are called SLATs,
mm-hmm.
Spousal Lifetime Access Trusts, where you will have someone who says, well, I'd like to be able to put money, you know, in a trust and get it out of my estate, but what if I want the money back?
Yep, exactly. And so this SLATs can come into play for tax planning, but there can also be some very non-tax planning items with SLATs, like the creditor protection. Oftentimes, clients will say, we have a REV trust, and so we're protected from our creditors. Absolutely not. One thing that we have now in the United States, and a number of states have enacted statutes, is what we call domestic asset protection trusts. So we have clients that will want to put assets in a trust, protect them from their creditors, and a SLAT can be an even bolstered asset protection trust because the beneficiary isn't, or the client who established the trust isn't technically a beneficiary, but guess what? They're married to the beneficiary. As long as you don't have divorce, there's going to be an indirect benefit there. So SLATs are becoming a big thing, and actually this will be a good segue let's talk about our high net worth clients and some tax planning opportunities. And I guess before we talk about our high net worth clients and tax opportunities, now we're going to get back to letting the tax tail wag the estate planning dog. All clients, as I mentioned earlier, Not all clients are going to have taxable estates, and in fact, very few will. But all clients will be subject to income tax and will be subject to capital gains tax. And this step up in basis that is included in the current act is a huge planning opportunity. And so to give you an example of what the step up in basis is let's say a client acquires a position in securities for $1 million. This is a long-term play, and by the time of the client's death, that security is increased to $3 million. We have built-in gain of $2 million in there. If the client right before death sold her position in that security, she'd have to recognize capital gains tax on that $2 million of gain. The step up in basis is a beautiful thing for our client, for our client's heirs, let's say. The step up in basis says, okay, if that client holds on to the security until her death, at death, the basis in that at security is the fair market value at death. So now the basis of the property moved from $1 million to $3 million. So if whomever the client's heirs are, let's say it's the client's husband, if husband goes and sells that security for $3 million, he pays zero capital gains tax because there is no gain. The basis is the date of death value, $3 million. He sold it for $3 million. That's a huge savings, whereas if the spouse had sold the property right before death and paying capital gains tax on the $2 million. So what we're seeing a lot of is planning for for the step up in basis. And there are a number of ways to do, We can do that through testamentary planning, which would be the planning we do in wills and trusts. But another thing and red flag you guys should be aware of is your clients that currently are beneficiaries of trust. If they're beneficiaries of trust, it's very likely that some of these trusts were created so that the property in the trust would be outside of your client's taxable estate. This was huge when we had an estate tax exemption amount of $675,000. It's still huge when the exemption amount was $5.49 million. It may not be as huge if your client has an exemption amount now of $11.2 million or $22 million. So one thing to look at is for any trust accounts you're managing or you're aware of, you may want to look at the value of those accounts. And if the value is under $11 million, your clients may want to find a way to bring that property back into their estate. So when they die, they get a step up in basis, and the property, and we get a do over with the basis. We save on the capital gains taxes. So So that is a major, major opportunity. And you guys are in very unique positions being the advisors and having access to all this information. The rule of thumb that I would do is look at the value of the trust for which your client is a beneficiary. Look at the value of your client's estate. And if the combined value of both of those is under the 11.2 exemption amount, there may be some major taxes you can save your client or your client's children. So looking at those two items, if we're under $11.2 million, there could be a major opportunity for your client, and you guys are looking like heroes for finding this, because while the CPAs know this is out here, they may not be the CPA for the client may not be the same CPA who's doing the tax returns or the trust. So they may not have all the information. You guys might. We're now on we're on page 6 talking about tax tail still exists, and I'm not necessarily going in order. Sorry about that. But portability and DSUI are still there. Clients should really consider, if a spouse dies, making the portability election. Unfortunately, the way that is right now is that you still have to file a full, or I guess it's somewhat simplified, but it's an estate tax return. Mark and I are very hopeful that someday the IRS will get its act together and allow us to file a DSUI election on a postcard. But just a quick reminder, the DSUI election, that's the deceased spouse, that's the portability, the deceased spouse unused exemption amount. So now if we have a client that die, a married client that dies this year, their exemption amount, their DSUI amount can be as high as $11.2 million. For clients that, and I'm trying to give you guys the threshold amount. And Mark, let me know if you disagree with this. I would say for clients with a net worth in excess of $5 million, it's husband and wife, they should consider doing a portability election. And the reason I'm saying $5 million is we never know if the exemption amount's going to go back down to $5 million. And really, you only lose an opportunity if you don't file a portability election. Do you think I'm too high or low at the $5 million threshold, Mark?
No, I don't think so. I think you have to also consider what the possibility is for the surviving spouse's potential net worth, whether mm-hmm. that surviving spouse may inherit some significant net worth, whether they're in a business that may prove to be valuable in the future, or whether some, securities that they hold may suddenly be, significantly valuable, whether they have an IPO interest that may, somehow be worth a great deal of money in the future. If you look at the cost benefit analysis of what it costs to file the 706, the estate tax return, to be able to get the portability over to the surviving spouse, the few thousands of dollars in attorneys or accounting fees that are so far outweighed by the value of that exemption that is really sort of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I agree. And again, the clients don't have to file it, but they should at least be made aware of upon death, the surviving spouse should at least be advised, this is an option. We should look at whether it makes sense to do it.
Well, one other just small point in terms of, if you're advising clients or looking at their estate planning documents, particularly in a blended family situation, because that portability election can only be made by the executor of the estate, you may be in a situation occasionally, and I've seen this in my mm-hmm. own practice, where the executor of the estate may refuse, if they're not related, to the decedent, to file that tax return. And so you want to make sure that the documents for the decedent's will or living trust require that executor, you know, to file it, and of course have the decedent's estate pick up the cost of that, but require the executor to do so, because otherwise you could certainly be in a fight and the decedent's family would be helpless if the executor or held hostage to the executor, if they refuse to file that tax return.
Yeah. And that's, for those clients where we're doing prenuptial agreements for, because of second marriages and children from previous marriages, we generally have a requirement that that the less wealthy spouse, we'll call him, direct his executor to file the DSUI return, because it is a very valuable option. One other thing to kind of keep your eye out on is, you know, we may, I'm on the board of a local charity in town, and a lot of the other board members, we're kind of nervous to see if we're going to see reduced charitable contributions because of the increase in the standard deduction. I'm not so sure yet, but what you may see is, there may be reduced charitable contributions during life and maybe more increased charitable contributions after death. And for the clients that I see that want to leave property to charity, the first thing I look at is to see if they have any retirement accounts, because retirement accounts are perfect to leave to charities. It's a win-win for everyone. The retirement accounts are the only assets, and we're not talking about Roths. Let's just talk about regular IRAs, regular 401ks, non-Roths. These retirement accounts are the only assets that when they're passed to the beneficiary and the beneficiary takes the distribution, they're going to be taxed. So a million dollar IRA going to a child, the child doesn't necessarily get $1 million. Now, we all know the stretch distributions and things like that, and you don't want to take it out all up front. Well, I can't tell you how many children I've had that have received the IRA. That's all they want. They thought they inherited $1 million that they could use tomorrow, and they can't. But if the client is leaving property to charities, let's say he has $1 million IRA and $1 million brokerage account. He wants to leave $1 million to charity, and he wants to leave $1 million to his son. Some wills may say 50-50 to charity, or 50-50, 50% to charity, 50% to my son. Well, then we get into issues. The son's going to get a portion of that retirement account. What really should happen is the charity should be the designated beneficiary of that retirement account. It gets $1 million. It's a tax-exempt organization, so it gets access to $1 million right away, and there's no tax going to the government. And then the brokerage account, that $1 million goes to the son. Because of the step-up in basis, to the extent there was any built-in gain, that's all gone away. So son has access to $1 million right after death. Moral of that story, if clients are interested in leaving property to charities upon their death and the client has IRAs, you may want to suggest that the client could look to and talk with their attorney or CPA about changing the beneficiary, not providing for the charity in the will or trust, but naming the charity as a designated beneficiary.
Also, Dylan, as a note on income tax planning these days, because the standard deduction now is so high, you'll have clients who might not want to make charitable gifts, you know, during life because they're not getting the charitable deduction. But if they, you know, they are entitled to give up to $100,000 a year out of their IRAs, and that's a good way to reduce their income tax and sort of avoid the fact that they can't, you know, if they're not itemizing, they can sort of circumvent the fact that they're not itemizing by being able to reduce their, you know, required minimum distribution and their tax on their IRA by using some of their IRA to give to their favorite charitable beneficiaries.
That's a great point, and that I think you're absolutely right, Mark. We're going to be seeing more and more of the IRA deduction and passing it on to charities, and that also reminds me. Promised we'd talk about this later. Well, I guess now is later from the income tax standpoint. With the increase of the charitable deduction of cash from 50% to 60% and the increase of the standard deduction, we may not see as many yearly charitable contributions. Rather, what we suspect we may see is a lot of bunching in a given year, especially if a client has a 1 year where there's a significant liquidity event or a high income year. You may see a lot of bunching where they're going to pre-fund or overfund a donor advised fund. So you may not see the annual contributions to donor advised fund. Rather, you may see one big lump sum payment, and then 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road, another big lump sum payment in the donor advised fund. I think the charitable contributions will continue. It's just charities may have to rebudget or figure out what they're going to do. That's going to be interesting, but I'm thinking of my board. I digress. The other thing that we cannot ignore is the generation skipping transfer tax. And let's see, where are we? We're at 12:05 now. Okay, I think we'll probably talk for another 10 or 15 minutes and then leave it open for questions. I do want to make sure we have time to address any questions. But the generation skipping transfer tax, what that tax is it's very similar to the estate and gift tax, but it's also different. The estate and gift tax applies when a transfer is made during life, and it doesn't matter to whom the transfer is made. The generation skipping transfer tax applies when there is a transfer to a generation once removed from the grantor. So think about your client, he wants to make a gift to grandkids. That gift would be subject to generation skipping transfer because it skips the generation below your client. It skips the kids. Portability does not apply to the generation skipping transfer tax. So I'm not going to focus too much on this because we're talking really about the individuals that have net worth 11 million plus, 22 million plus for families. But if you have, if you are working with clients in that realm, we need to make sure that if we do any gifting, we're accounting for the GST tax. One thing I think we're going to see more of, especially with the $10,000 deduction limitation on the SALT tax, the state and local tax, is I'm not sure how many clients we're going to see moving to a tax-free jurisdiction. They live where they do because they like the state. Some don't. Some clients move. But I think we may see a lot of trusts that are now in existence that are moving. I've actually had a number of trusts, 6 trusts this year, that we've moved from Colorado, which is certainly not a high taxing state, we're at around 4%, to Delaware, a non-tax state, or Wyoming, or Nevada, or so forth. And so another thing to look at is if your client has trusts that are located, situs, the trustee is located in one of these high tax states. And Crystal, I hope I think you guys have some trust offices in no tax states, but you may want to consider whether it makes sense to move to a low tax state. Again, with the directed trust, if you guys are the trust directors over investments, it doesn't matter where you're located, it just matters where the trust is located. So you're not going to have to move but this really avoids state income tax issues. So number one, we trust will save on no state income tax, and then that's a win-win now. With the Tax Act that limits the deductibility for state income taxes. Another thing you may be seeing, and you know, we'll be talking to clients about are upstream gifts. Historically, a client making a gift to a parent or a grandparent has been a big, big no-no because we don't want it in the parents' or grandparents' taxable estate. Well, now with the 11.2, 22.4 exemption amounts, if the parents are not going to have a taxable estate and the client has some significantly appreciated asset that they are not going to need for at least 3 years, there are certain rules relating to that. But if they may want to consider making gifts to the parents or grandparents in the hopes that when the parent or grandparent dies, that person will leave the property back to the kid, and then the kid can sell the property and have no capital gains tax. So you may be seeing a little more of that. Before I get into Mark to the I just want to spend a few minutes on the planning for our high net worth clients. Any other income tax things that that you can think of? I think we've covered it all, and I know it's I'm sure there's things we left out. It's hard to encompass everything in an hour and a half.
On the income tax side, I think that's a pretty good summary. I mean, we could certainly go into a great deal of more depth on the new 20% deduction, which is going to be highly complicated, and there's going to be a great many regulations that are going to need to be written to flesh that out, and we'll see how many years it takes for Treasury to write those regulations.
Well, especially if we have the if we're keeping with the one in, two out regulations. I don't know. I think the Treasury is going to have a harder time figuring what two regulations to get rid of to allow that one in.
Right.
Okay, so we just want to spend maybe a couple minutes on some planning opportunities for the high net worth clients, and then we'll open it up for questions. Really, I don't think with the doubling of the exemptions, I don't think that there's many new planning opportunities. I think the old tried and true methods are going to continue to be there, except we're now, instead of doing this for clients with 10 plus million, we'll be doing this for clients with, or families with 20 plus million dollars. And so for those clients, things you want to look at are the transfer and freeze planning. Identifying assets that are likely to appreciate significantly in value. One category that always comes up is a client's about to sell their business. As long as we do not have a signed purchase and sale agreement, there's opportunities that can exist to allow the client to transfer all or a portion of her interest in the business to a trust, essentially freezing the value at that time in the trust. And there's still a number of discounting options that are available. The 2704 regs have gone by the wayside, so we don't have to worry about discounting issues. So transfer and freeze planning still works. Shifting income-producing property to family members who may be in lower income tax brackets, you've got to keep in mind the kiddie tax. So this would be gifting property to adult children who are in a lower tax bracket than their parents are. Again, we talked about transferring appreciated property out of the client's taxable estate. There are two ways to do that. One is making a gift. A lot of times we'll do this in a trust. They make a gift of that property to the trust, and let's say we have a good example is, let's say we have a minority interest in a business that the client thinks will sell in a year, maybe within the year, but no purchase and sale agreement has been entered into. We get a discounted value of that interest of $5 million, put it in the trust, business sells, and the interest ends up receiving $10 million or $8 million. That's a perfect example. It costs the client $5 million of exemption amount to transfer $8 million out. Sometimes clients may not want to do that, and there may be cash flow reasons for that. They want to use a portion of the cash from the sale of the business. So what we do instead is we gift a small amount, maybe 10% of the value of the business, gift that in cash to the trust, and then the trust turns around and purchases the client's interest in the business for the cash down payment and the promissory note. And that promissory note provides the cash flow the client needs for the next succeeding years. Also, the spousal lifetime access trust. This is, as Mark mentioned earlier, those can be great for the, not only creditor protection, but we're seeing a lot of these with our clients with taxable estates. They don't want to get rid of the they don't want to necessarily have this go to the next generation and not be able to benefit from all. So rather what they do is they create a trust. Husband creates a trust, transfers property in the trust. Wife's the beneficiary. Children are remainder beneficiaries. So during wife's lifetime, she has access to that, and then we can have some powers of appointment that it could come back to husband, perhaps. Other things you may see are the qualified personal residence trust. I mean, the litany of names, the ILITs, the GRATs, the CRETs, the QPERTs, those are all still going to be in play for the clients with the taxable estate. So really what we hope you may have gotten out of this during the presentation is looking at the planning opportunities that exist now for clients that do not necessarily have a taxable estate. There's a litany of items that need to be addressed. We need to look at their, if these clients are beneficiaries of trust, look at those trusts. Does it make sense to continue those trusts? Is it their way to get those trust assets in the client's estate now? Because they're never going to get the $11 million threshold. Focusing on, so the focus is, for these clients is really the income planning, the step up in basis, utilizing the DSUI amount and all of that. So with that, I guess we'll open it up for questions.
Dylan, can you hear me? Great.
Yep.
Great presentation. Thank you very much. This is Keith Tillers in Dallas. And we did have a question come up earlier, and I'll just read it to you. Investment expenses, curious to know if they could still be utilized as basis adjustments.
That's a good question. And Keith, if send me your email, I will look into that. I would think, I didn't see anything that that said they can't be used to, as basis adjustments. Do you know that off the top of your head, Mark?
I don't.
Okay, but Keith, if you'll send me an email, or if there's an email, Crystal, that I can send out to the group, I will confirm that. I do not know off the top of my head. My gut tells me that would be a huge, that's even a bigger penalty. So I think the answer is probably going to be yes, but let me confirm that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
We have a question from the Houston market.
Hi, it's Lynn Mathery in Houston. One quick comment, using the RMD to go to charity can also help benefit clients to reduce their IRMA on their Medicare surtax. And the second question I have is, solve the UGMA problem would be, would it be possible to transfer that UGMA to a 529 that's a designated 529, because you can't change the beneficiary? And then once that child is 18 and or 22, or maybe like my daughter, 30, finishing college, and if there's any money left, they're an adult, they're the beneficiary, they take it out, and pay the 10% of penalty, but they only pay at their tax rate, which presumably is not the trust tax rate. So couldn't you transfer these UGMA accounts, and then once those kids turn 18, put it into their tax bracket, they file their own return?
Well, you'd need to... That's not a bad idea. I haven't thought about that. Is there any legal impediment from transferring an UGMA account to a 529 if the minor is the owner of the 529? I don't think there would be.
Well, a minor's never going to be an owner of a 529.
Yeah,
we do it all the time. You can transfer it.
Yeah, no, we can be. The owner can also be the beneficiary.
The owner would be the parent, and then the beneficiary the parent could make the child the contingent beneficiary. Once they turn 18, the parent says, you got it, unless they're going to run off with a motorcycle gang or something. Money.
Did you just come up with this? Have you heard? I like this idea. Yeah, I haven't seen this.
I'm thinking of how do we fix this, you know? I'm trying to. We think not just Dallas.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any issues with that.
They pay tax on the gain, though, too.
Well, but at least it's
that's going to be the issue.
They have at least 10 years tax deferral. That 10% penalty is going to be less than the taxes they would have paid all along.
No, the tax on the gain, what you need to look at is there any built-in gain in the UGMA right now? If it's just all sitting in cash, sure. But, I mean, the issue you're going to the and this is where the trap is you're going to have UGMAs that have built-in gain right now. And now all of a sudden, okay, they're at trust tax rates. I would think if you're going to – that I could see an issue being if you're going to try to do an in-kind distribution, if the IRS catches wind of this, they may deem that contribution a taxable event.
Yeah, they will, for sure.
Yeah. But if you have an UGMA account sitting in cash?
The contribution isn't a taxable event. The selling of the asset in the UGMA is a taxable event. So you have to spread that out over several years.
Yeah.
If there was that,
I think it could work, but what I would think is to the extent, let's say, to the extent you have built-in capital gains in the UGMA account and you were looking to do an in-kind distribution to the 529, I think there's going to be a risk there that the IRS is going to treat that transfer as taxable. Transferring the cash, yeah. I don't see any reason for that. And then you're right. It's the and frankly, I mean, that may get some people who don't have 529s. Give them the 529s. Perfect. You just help fund college or private school now. And to the extent anything's left over if we have a high UGMA account, I think you're right. Run the numbers, but the penalty may hurt when you do it, but in the long run, it may be less than the tax that'd be paid out each year.
Okay, well, thank you. Being right's our job.
I like that. I may have to use what Houston. What's your name again? I'll give you credit for this.
Lynn Macri.
Macri, thank you. I'll look at that. But that I hadn't thought of that. Interesting.
Can I clarify just a question related to the step up in basis and how it's changed? So the situation I'm thinking of is a joint brokerage account set up in the name of husband and wife. And husband dies, there's still just a 50% step up in basis, correct? It's not a wouldn't be 100% step up in basis for the surviving spouse, would it?
Unless you're in a community, if you're in a community property state, it's 100%.
Okay.
But nothing's changed. It's the same rule as it always been. But yeah, community property, states, you get a 100% step up.
Yeah, Texas and California are better.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have any more questions? All right. Thank you, Dylan, for your time. If you're not on our distribution list, please see your local host and have a great rest of your day.